We're closing in on the final episodes of season one, and I wanted to remind you that this thing does not happen without tension climbing. Not only do they make the best wooden training tools on the planet, but they also took a chance on a completely unproven podcast idea because they believe in the value of history and community. When you use the code STONE, that's STONE, for 10% off at tensionclimbing.com, you're letting them know how much you appreciate that support, and it helps us let them know that it was a good investment. So please, head to tensionclimbing.com, tell them thanks, and thank you for your support. Tensionclimbing.com, mastery over success. In his book, Beyond the Summit, Todd Skinner wrote, "Mike Lilligren had a schoolboy face and Dennis the Menace hair, an irritatingly endless sense of humor, and a tinkerer's mind for detail." The schoolboy face is a little more grizzled now. The Dennis the Menace hair and the sense of humor, still intact. And the tinkerer's mind for detail, that led to Mike co-founding Maven, high-end, direct-to-consumer sports optic company serving modern outdoors people. But Todd also wrote,
"He would turn into the closer on the expedition, the one who kept getting stronger as the burden increased, the keystone that bridged the way to the summit."
Todd had no idea how right he really was. Mike doesn't just wait for the challenge to present itself before he transforms into the closer. He purposely issues the challenge himself. Having spent years climbing terrain of every sort in far-flung locations, Mike could climb just about any 5'11 on Earth. Wet, windy, icy, sun-baked in the desert, scary runouts or slippery slabs. All of it. And as he neared 50 years old, with a growing business and a daughter graduating from high school, he wondered if he could climb harder. 5'13 seemed to require some sort of higher dedication, a willingness to do more, to believe bigger, to try harder. It would require a closer. And he couldn't just pick any 5'13. At the Addiction Wall in Sinks Canyon, there's an unassuming pitch of spaced out edges, small pockets, and slippery feet. Surplus Fusion Reaction has no use for duct taped on rubber knee pads or any other tricks. Just a flat pane of limestone, about 20 degrees overhanging, with nowhere to hide. You just have to keep moving, one big reach after another. As you get higher, the holds get smaller. It might very well be the hardest 13A of the style in the state. And that one? It would definitely require a closer. And so he trained. Hard. He made the time because time doesn't just appear out of thin air, and there was always something else to be done. It wasn't about balance, but compromise, sacrifice, getting the job done. A team rallied around him, not because he needed the help, but because when Mike has decided he wants to do something, you just want to be on his team. With his longtime friend, the person he'd first come to Lander with to train for a trip to the Karakoram for a chance to climb a golden rocket ship-shaped tower, Steve Bechtel, on Belay, Mike checked his knot one last time. He looked up at the route, scanned the first sequence he knew so well, closed his eyes, took a breath, and focused. And then, like he had so many times before, he closed the deal.
Mike, welcome to Written in Stone, man.
Wow, glad to be here. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm psyched to get to sit down with you. This is a funny town in that we live close to each other, but never see each other. And that seems to happen with just about everybody here.
I am blown away by that, how often I don't see the people that I value in this town. And then I just run into them at the crag or in passing. Typically, I'm leaving the crag about the time they show up because the old people crowd that I roll with roll up there at like first sun instead of last sun. But it's great to sit down with you. It's great to see. I'm so glad you're in our town.
Man, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, you've listened to the podcast, so you know how this thing works. And before we get really started, I have a question for you. If you could use Maven's most powerful scope to look back into the past and watch Todd Skinner on Anyone Ascent, which one do you watch?
Oh, geez. This is a tough one. And we started before this conversation talking about how I have a terrible memory for route names and when I close my eyes and someone asks me, you know, when I think about Todd and I close my eyes and think about Todd, there's one pitch of climbing that I see him climb. Like it's just ingrained in my memory. And of course it's on Trango Tower. And so I'm not saying that that's what I want to go relive, but that's what I actually do relive when I think of Todd. You know, I climbed with him a ton on limestone. I climbed with him a ton on granite and on lots of different things. I mean, you know how it is in this town. You get, well, and you know how it was with Todd. He's like sucking in partners. Like he'd pull you up like, hey, give me a play on this.
Right.
There's a 12 plus pitch right after the crux on Trango Tower. So I had belayed him on the crux pitch, the 513 traverse. And the next pitch is a hard 512 dihedral that I had cleaned. I had aid climbed up it and I'd cleaned off one of the walls. And so, and as I was coming down, I thought, oh crap, I don't know if I can do this thing. This thing's hard. And so, you know, because I was cleaning the pitch, it was sort of assumed it was going to be my pitch. And Todd came across the traverse and got to that belay. And I still like, he just said, all right, you ready for this one? And I said, God, Todd, I just really don't know if I am today. And he goes, well, do you mind if I give it a go? And I'm like, sure, why not? You know? And so I gave him a belay. And I closed my eyes on this because it's this flaring lie back up a dihedral. The left wall is overhanging. And the right wall is a slab, but it's a little bit ricey. And there's not a lot of good holds. All the holds face down. It's like a series of overlaps, but all the holds face down. So there's nothing to really. And I had just been floundering up this thing trying to clean it. And he sets off after doing this really, you know, I'd been belaying him on all these steep limestone. I'd been belaying him on crazy thin granite. And he heads up this thing crack climbing. Like I had never seen Todd crack climb, which is weird.
Yeah,
I'd never
totally.
Seen it. And I mean, I knew about the days. I'd read the books. I knew he was fluid. He was so smooth. And this is at 19,000 feet. Like, and we're on day 7 or 8. Like we're sucking wind. We're struggling. And he was so fluid through this climb and such a beautiful crack climber. And very few people saw that from him, you know, in that era, because all the hard climbing was pockets and edges and steep.
Yeah.
And so beautiful. And Todd was a beautiful climber. Like watching his movement was, it wasn't thrusting. It wasn't yelling and screaming. It was fluidity. And near perfection. And that's what I think of. I don't know if I can imagine Todd climbing anything but that. Like that's just ingrained in my brain.
Yeah, that's cool. And, you know, it reminds me of something. You know, Todd had that like Vita Vu education. And on one of my very first trips to Vita Vu, I met Bob Scarpelli.
Which is always exciting.
Yes, yeah, always exciting. And Bob took my friend and I to one of his boulder problems, this off with roof. And my friend is struggling and going almost nowhere, just slipping and sliding. And Bob is just standing there with his arms crossed and shaking his head. And finally he says, big arms, little brains. And then I watched Bob climb it. And it was like ballet.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, the rock and the roots there are fierce, but you can't meet them with that.
Right.
You have to meet them with this level of like grace.
Yeah. Grace under tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like total body tension, but slow, purposeful movement. So yeah, there's so many things that he did that would have been really fun to go back and see and be there.
Yeah.
Especially in the early days when he was sort of, you know, the route thief, you know, like swooping in and doing the hard projects. And it would have been fun to be a bird on the wall and just watch those things happen. But for me, it's always that like the transition from power and energy, of which he had in spades. It was overflowing with power and energy, yet he had that technical grace to just be smooth and calm when that's what mattered.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, the way I understand it, based on Todd's book and his articles, you two didn't really know each other when you and Bobby came to get on the trip. Is that true?
That's pretty much true. So, Steve Bechtel and I were college roommates, and Steve came in to Half Dome, the Half Dome project with Todd,
right.
And really sort of, he saved the day on that one. I mean, not alone. There were other,
right.
But he came in and Todd was really impressed by Steve's commitment level. And so as Todd started to plan this next project, and Triangle Tower was like the project in his brain at the time, he met with Steve and he's like, I need people that'll be like that. I need people that will stick with it. He's sort of famous for saying, you can't make a rock climber tough, but you can make a tough person a rock climber or good climber or great climber or whatever. So he asked Steve if he could, who was on that team. And Steve and I had done some crazy stuff together and we were always adventure climbing partners. In fact, we very rarely sport climb together. The story that you told in the beginning about Steve belaying me is absolutely true, but it's very rare. Like we just don't sport climb that often together, but we really have had some crazy adventures. Mm. And so Steve recommended me to Todd and Todd and I met like at a slideshow. I saw he and Paul do a slideshow about
South A.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it was, of course, hero worship. But we had just met. And so we were introduced, we did a little bit of climbing together, but we didn't really know each other at all. Even to the point of after I moved here and we headed off on the trip, we were acquaintances.
Mm-hmm. When you came and talked to him and were planning the trip, did his personality and who he was match up with the person at the slideshow that you thought he was?
Well, yeah. I mean, yes, Todd was a showman.
Yeah.
And so he was, and not nearly the showman Paul, because Paul can sing.
Yeah.
But he's a showman and he was all the way through preparation, especially was a showman. Actually, it's really interesting. He didn't become, I didn't get a more of an insight into his personality until we were really in the Karakoram.
Mm.
Because everything I saw up to Todd up to that point was sort of on point and on stage. And which turns out in retrospect it was exactly what we needed.
Sure.
It was kind of annoying at the time. Like we felt like we were doing all the logistical work, weighing out the rice and figuring out how much fuel we needed and sewing bags for battery packs and just all kinds of weird stuff we were doing. Meanwhile, Todd was just on the phone.
Yeah.
The whole time.
Yeah.
But he was on the phone getting money from Reebok.
He's talking to
so
Reebok.
He could do the show. Yeah, do the trip. And then once we got to Pakistan, he was again the showman, just like working the logistics of the liaison officer, of the transportation, just all of that, being the upfront leader that I expected him to be. The boss of the show, the center point of attention, all of those things that you imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And Todd was 100%. But at the same time, once we stepped into the mountains, he became a teammate.
Mm.
And I've told many people, and I felt all the way through from the moment that we got onto the wall, I was in charge of the expedition. It was really weird because I did not feel comfortable with that. But Todd all of a sudden was deferring to me to, and I'm not trying to say this as I'm not saying that. He led from within within the team and he made me feel empowered to take charge and make decisions and help drive the pathway of the expedition. Meanwhile, he was kicking ass leading all the hard stuff. And what Todd didn't like was aid climbing. So he was terrified to go up in that way and hang on gear and to try to kind of help move the rope up. But it was really interesting. So that part of his personality, I totally experienced once I was in the mountains. And then I experienced that time and time again with him over the next many years.
Yeah. Well, I'm jumping way ahead here because you prompted it, but now running a company like Maven, do you see those like leadership by allowing other people to run things and lead things themselves? Do you see that as a big lesson you took away?
Oh yeah. I hadn't ever thought about that before, to be honest with you. I always think of myself as my sort of own style of leader. And in a lot of ways, I'm a lot like Todd in that I'm okay with being up front and I'm all right to be the center of attention or to get up on a stage. That scares me zero, not at all. But on the other hand, I have learned that the best part of leadership is teamwork, is the team. And my way is not the way. And there's a lot to be learned by letting people, you know, first of all, you got to get the right partners and trust them to do what they need to do.
Yeah.
And then they're going to do it. And yeah, I think I learned a lot of that from him, you know, directly or indirectly, or at least I learned it on the life I lived in, you know, that he overlapped.
Yeah.
So
I wondered about that because in my like, you know, you basically live down the street from me, but I'm like, I have to do some research, you know, just to walk in there prepared. And I read your LinkedIn profile and I think you use the word teamwork like 12 times in your LinkedIn profile. And so I wondered if that was like a part of
absolutely.
What came from that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I, one of my business partners is comes from a big athletic background and I don't, you know, very team sports. I mean like football, basketball.
Right.
And he talks all the time about the power of team and how important team is. And, I realized, I mean, we've worked together now for 20 years. So, I've realized in that time period that I have exactly that same ethos. But I learned it all through climbing. Like climbing was the very first physical thing I was ever good at. You know, maybe hiking in the woods and then climbing. Right. I was terrible at any ball sports, terrible at any. But the teamwork you get from climbing is super intense.
Totally.
And just absolutely 100% founded in trust.
Yeah.
And that part is super important to me and the people I work with. And it's funny that you can get that in so many different ways, but I definitely got a lot of it from Todd.
Yeah. Had you done any travel like that, like to a wild place like Pakistan prior?
No. I mean, I traveled a lot as a growing up. I have a military, my dad was in the military. And so I traveled. I was born in Germany and I lived around the world, but it was always very safe and comfortable and not scary. So that was my first wild travel. And still, when I look back, probably my wildest travel overall. I mean, I've been to more remote places. You know, the Porter network of communication in the Karakoram, in the 1990s was actually amazing. Mm. Like stuff would happen. Like when Allison Hargraves and the big accident happened on K2, like that communication was happening within hours. All up and down the Karakoram. And you could, although there were no cell phones and a satellite phone was almost unheard of at the time, still information moved very quickly. I spent several weeks in the middle of the Wind River Mountains about 2 years after that. And that is maybe the most remote place I've ever been in my life. There was no communication. There was no rescue.
Wow.
There actually was a rescue, but that's a whole different story. but someone had to walk out and ask for it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me because, you know, I met my wife here in Lander, and one of the things about her that really drew me in was she was talking about all this travel she'd done. Like she'd lived in Mongolia and she'd, you know, traveled all across Asia by herself. And it was Todd who'd bought her the ticket there.
Right.
For nannying for them for the summer. And Todd had inspired her to do this travel. And in my mind, I'm like coming to Wyoming thinking, oh, these like small town Wyoming people.
Isolated.
They're isolated, no culture.
Bunch of hicks.
But then I come here and everyone I meet has like been to all these wild and remote places, you know? I think that's really fascinating that Todd and the people from here
Well, and some of that is, I mean, it's certainly Todd and a lot of the climbers that are attracted here, but it's also Knowles.
Yeah.
The National Outdoor Leadership School has really changed this town. We are a super eclectic, varied town for being in the middle of Wyoming. I think that's what makes it, one of the things that makes it such a lovely place is the diversity of culture. Mm-hmm. Now, that definitely still comes in quotes.
Yes.
As I'm sure you know.
Big air quotes.
Yeah, big air quotes of the diversity we have here. But for Wyoming, we do a pretty good job and we have a lot of experience. And that makes it a pretty fun culture community to hang out in.
Yeah, totally. I'm going to take you back there a little bit to the Karakoram. You're on Trango, or you just arrive. You're seeing the wall for the first time. The person that was the impetus for you being there gets sick and has to leave.
Yeah.
Steve has to come back to the States. What was going through your head in that moment?
It was brutal. I mean, he was getting pretty sick on the just on the couple days approach, the last couple days of the 5 days we were walking in. And but by the time we got to base camp, he was incapacitated, like could not leave his tent.
It's hard to imagine Steve incapacitated.
Isn't it? I've seen it a couple times
That's
now.
That's a wild
and it is a wild
thing to consider.
There is the capacity of Steve Bechtel is very great, as you know.
Yeah.
To see him at absolute near zero is devastating. To have him be the only real reason you're there and the contact for being there, sort of the hinge pin of the entire expedition.
Yeah.
I mean, in my mind, and I've read back through my journals, it was over. Like I was done. But what we had, and all you ever have in those kinds of situations is the work to get done. And so you just have a task list and you start working the task list. So you're devastated, you're heartbroken, you don't know how you can take another step, but all you can do is take another step. And you just say, all right, well, the next thing I have to do is move this 500 pounds of gear from this base camp to the top of this notch. And I'm just going to focus on that. And, and then you get up there and you're like, well, okay, well, there's 1,000 feet of climbing right above us. It's been done before. It's not that hard. I can't catch my breath, but we're going to do that. And so, just like you start the task list and you start working through it. And by the time you realize, you're a couple weeks into it and you've been working through the list and you're almost head down, you're not looking up, you're looking forward. And you have to look up to do something new. You start to realize, oh shoot. Okay. Things are working. And we can make this work and start a conversation. And luckily, Todd and Bobby were such awesome partners. Mm. Like Bobby was just bubbling enthusiasm. Mm. He's kind of tall, gangly, a little bit out of control all of the time. And but also just super passionate and dedicated. And so he was just upbeat and driven. And Todd was, of course, a laser. So we were not like, the weapon we had in his mind was time, and we were going to be there until it was done.
Mm.
And we used that weapon a lot.
Yeah, no doubt. Talk to me about Jeff coming up on the wall. That's such a wild twist in this story.
Holy crap.
Is it just like something that they fed the Bechtels when they were kids, or what is it?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it is. Having met their dad, I realized that it is 100% genetic.
Mm.
Absolutely. And their mom, actually, to be honest, it's for sure a combination of Tom and Linda that made the Bechtel boys and Leslie for that matter.
Yeah, Leslie
as
too.
Tough as nails. And incredibly optimistic and positive. And Jeff, as the youngest, got the entire filter paper load of that. Like all of the stuff filtered through his whole family and ended up in him. And so he is by far the toughest, by far the funniest, by far the most stubborn. And Leslie and Steve may argue with me on that, but that guy cannot be stopped. And so he literally said, "Move over, I'm coming up." and he meant it 100%. And he was either going to come up, whether I taught him how to Jumar or not. Like, he was going to figure it out if he had to hand over hand up that fixed line. And so literally, I mean, the kid learned how to, and the kid, he was 21 at the time, learned how to Jumar up ropes. Then he learned how to, you know, haul loads, and he hauled loads like, you know, 3 or 4 a day. You know, so rappelling 1,000 feet, filling a backpack with as much as he could haul and going back up. And which I could do like maybe once.
Right.
And he did it 3 or 4 times a day. And then he was like, I don't feel like I'm contributing enough. So I want to learn how to lead. So he led 10 plus at 19,200 feet, 19,300. Yeah.
Amazing.
Like, learned how to lead. Like, I just went up and I placed the gear. I explained how to place gear. He went up, he like looked at it, took it out, put it back in, and then just led the pitch.
I love it. And you know what? I hadn't thought about it until you just said it, but knowing Steve and Leslie both, like, there's a quiet toughness and this like bubbly joy in there as well.
Yeah.
When you combine those two, if Jeff makes cakes as good as Leslie, then he might be the greatest human.
Yeah, that I've never seen him. You know, I can't speak to that one side or one way or another. But if he set his mind to it, I have no doubt that he could do it without a problem. What he does, he's a little less sarcastic than his older siblings.
Yeah.
Which is, you know,
it's hard to be less sarcastic than Steve.
That is true. That is true. Sarcasm is a wonderful thing, and I love Steve's sarcasm, but I have to say, 60 days on a wall, it's nice to have just bubbly humor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when Jeff said, move over, I'm coming up, that very easily could also have just been a major liability.
Oh, for sure.
And I'm sure that had to be going through your minds.
You know, it's funny. I actually don't think for a moment that we ever thought it was a liability. Certainly other people did. And our liaison officer in for sure like messaged us right away and said, this is a really terrible idea. You cannot do this. We never thought it really was a liability. We just, you know, kind of a one step at a time. We certainly, we didn't think that Jumaring up the ropes was any big deal. Like that's a pretty low, from an insider perspective, that's a pretty low skill set.
Sure.
And the safety factor is pretty controllable. And so, I mean, now as an adult looking back, I can see that why one would think that.
And maybe it's different if you're like already at hanging camp and he says, I'm coming up.
Right.
But because he gets to come up to this ledge.
Right.
And then later he's like, I'm coming up to Notch camp or whatever.
Exactly. And that was where it was in our mind. It's like, oh, he's just coming up to the ledge. Yeah. And that's great. And he's tougher than us. He's bigger than us. He can haul some loads. And he got really good at that. And then you're like, well, shoot, you're really good at that. So why don't you haul him up to this next camp?
Yeah.
And so, so then it wasn't long. It was, you know, 5-6 days of doing the lower loads until he was coming up to the higher camp.
Yeah.
And then, actually leading a pitch on the middle of it. I think he led 2 of them overall. It was crazy.
You've already sort of answered this question, but I want to talk about this moment a little bit where the storm comes. As Todd tells it, you were the voice of reason that very likely saved all of your lives. And you just felt comfortable to say, nope, you're wrong. We're going down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had climbed the whole thing, right? Like, we climbed everything. It was all about trying to capture the story, which, I mean, I know you can appreciate, but Todd was also super important to him capturing the story. So we were climbing more pitches and we were doing more things. And we had only like freed the last pitch a couple days before that, nearly at the storm, but the storm was coming in. This was the third major storm that we'd experienced. We were up at high camp, at the hanging camp. It was starting to get, it was dangerous. And so we were sitting around like we did so much time in the storm talking about what needs to happen, what options. And I sort of put my foot down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I felt comfortable enough to say, look, no, we're at the limit. We have got to get down, or this, we may never get down off this. And it's interesting because when we first got to that hanging camp, there was a haul bag there from a Swiss team that had fallen. Guy had broken his leg. He had to get evac'd. And so, like, you know, the socks I was wearing, the hat I wore, a bunch of the cams I had were all from this team that had to get evac'd from this place. And so it's in your mind, like, there's death, and people had died during that trip all around us. And, you know, you can't take those things lightly. However, we had already stayed 30 days past that.
Right.
I did feel comfortable to just say, no, it's over. And Todd just completely said, okay, let's do it. Yeah. He didn't fight me one more. He knew that I was the right, that I was in the right, and that I was probably more of a right mind. I don't mean to say that he wasn't in a good mind, but he was so obsessed with the minutiae, the detail, that he realized that I was seeing the big picture.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. And I love that you sort of led this whole conversation with that, that he, once you were on the wall, he just, you know, sort of acquiesced the lead to you in terms of what we're doing up here.
Yeah, I'm still blown away by it, and it's part of the reason why it's a part of the story that I retell and relive, is because it was so out of the public persona of Todd.
Yeah.
You know, he was so determined, such a upfront leader. The man with the ideas, the man with the idea of how to execute the ideas. Yet when we were there, it became very mutual and oftentimes deferential, where he just would say, what do you think we should do? How do you think we should team up? We had an odd team in the beginning too, because there were three of us.
Sure.
So, you know, sometimes a team of two would climb and one person would rest. Most times a team of two would climb and one person would work. They would haul loads, or they would just move gear around. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I would go solo aid climbing and try to push the rope up higher while Todd and Bobby were trying to free pitches. Sure. But it was all, and then once Jeff showed up, then we moved it more into a more normal two by two team.
Yeah.
And it would divide in different ways depending on whose pitch we were projecting or what needed to happen.
Well, you know, the more I read about leadership and the great leaders of either business or the world in general, they all have this quality where it was, I like have the plan and I build a team, but I'm building a team of people who I believe in, and I'm very willing to listen to them as well.
Yeah.
It's almost like I want to build the people who can replace me. I want to put them in place there.
For sure. For sure.
And I think that's fascinating that Todd brought that onto that expedition.
Yeah, I do too. And I revisit it in my brain quite frequently because I think it's something worth emulating.
Yeah.
And I don't know how well I do it. I mean, I do it better some days than others.
Sure.
But
Todd did it better some days than others.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
What did it feel like sitting in that tent for so many days with just those dudes?
Oh my gosh. At the time, it was, I mean, it depending on the day, but at the time it was grueling to be still for that long. And how that is, like, we're not a group of people that are designed to wait.
Right.
I was never good at climbing in Patagonia because I just couldn't wait long enough.
Yeah.
The stories that would float around that, you know, we read a lot of books and we would tell each other the stories from books, but we'd also make up stories. And so, you know, the typical storm day, especially when Jeff was there, was really even more interesting. You know, we'd wake up, we were in two different tents, but you're just not going to sit in the two different tents. So all four of us would crawl into a two-man tent, these were comfortable two-man tents, but these were not four-man tents with two people sleeping in them. So all four of us would crawl into a two-man tent. We'd usually make a pot of water in the vestibule and just drink coffee and then tea. and just keep melting snow and just keep drinking fluids and getting up to go to the bathroom and coming back in and just talking and chatting for the majority of the day. So you'd get up, you know, make a pot of coffee. I usually would get up and melt water and make coffee. We'd sit around and chat for a while. And then one of us would finally like, okay, I'm hungry. And you get up and make some kind of breakfast. Then sometimes you disperse a little bit and go do some things. And then you regroup just around lunchtime and do the whole thing all afternoon. And yeah, literally sitting, just leaning on each other, talking for days and days and days. Yeah, the longest stretch I think was a 10-day storm.
Wow.
That we just sat around for 10 days. And that was the big brutal one where so much death happened around us.
Yeah, I think especially men in this society that we now live in very rarely get to know other men in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think that that level of intimacy, that closeness is really hard, especially in normal society where you're pulled in 15,000 different directions.
Right.
Always a distraction, always something to do, always on the move.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a gift, really. I'm sure it didn't feel like a gift at the time.
In retrospect, I agree 100%. at the time, it was definitely not a gift. And again, reading back through my journals, I talked several times about how I would give up, how I would be willing to give up if I wasn't surrounded by people sort of pulling me along and pushing me along.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've experienced that at other times in my life, in other ways, that I'm on the verge of giving up or not feeling like I can move forward on what I'm doing, but being surrounded by people who are pulling me along or pushing me along or both. And it's that's a true team.
It's valuable.
That's a
to
true
have
team.
That.
It's super valuable.
Yeah.
May we all have it in our friends and family. Because it gets you through the hard times. And then it amplifies the good times.
Totally. You led to the summit, right?
I did.
You had been sitting on the side of that tower for a couple of months at this point.
Right.
Touching it, leaning against it, always having to look up at it.
Right.
What did it feel like to finally be on the top and there's no more up to look at?
You know, it was definitely a super surreal. I mean, that place is insane anyway. Yeah. Just spectacular in all directions. But to see the 365 from up there, you know, to look over at the Great Trango Tower and to, you know, all the Gasherbrums and all of those mountains around and be sort of on a pinnacle was super, super surreal. The pitch to get up there, the kind of two pitches to get up there were a bit harrowing. I had the wrong equipment with me. I wasn't prepared to summit on the day we actually summited. So I didn't have crampons with me. I only had one ice tool. And so I was kicking steps and it was stupid in retrospect. Like I just come back another day.
Yeah.
To like fix the rope, come back with the gear. But so I was really tired and exhausted, but that mental exhaustion, exhilaration that you have when you've done something that you didn't know you could do, you've pushed through something. And so there was a super intense feeling of sort of joy from that. I've had that a few other times in climbing where I've climbed a pitch or a mountain or a route that was on the edge of everything I was capable of. And that exhilaration of doing something you just barely did is pretty amazing. And then to combine that with just this just stupidly insane environment that we were in. But simultaneous to that, there was because Todd had made it very clear we weren't done with that route until we were done with that route. Like, you know, so there were several pitches still to free climb. There were lots of film capture things that we had talked through because we had made lots of notes about what we wanted to capture. Our film team, we had a photographer with us early on in the expedition, but he had left shortly after we left Bill Hatcher. And he had left shortly after we hit that hanging camp. And he's like, well, I have everything I need except for the summit photo. So if you just get the summit photo, that's all I need. Mm. And so we had this whole list of work that we, like, I started out talking about all the work in the list.
Right.
We had the list, all the work. So it simultaneously felt like I didn't have that feeling I've had at the top of other climbs, like, oh, shoot, all I have to do is get down. Right. Get down safely and I'm done. It wasn't that yet. Mm. It was still like, okay, let's get the work done.
Wow.
So we can go home.
That's fascinating. A little bit of relief and then also, not done yet.
Not done yet. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Still got to pay the bills.
Well, there's something I have to know. There's a discrepancy between Todd's book, Beyond the Summit, and the Nat Geo article. When you're on the summit, he talks about you set up a video camera, you're all talking into a video camera, and the story he tells is that Jeff says, you know, I'd like to donate this climb, and then someone corrects him and said, you mean dedicate.
Right.
In his book, he says, you say, you correct Jeff. In the Nat Geo article, he said, he corrects Jeff. And I want to know if he stole your thunder.
Wow. That's really interesting. And since I'm the only one who can
you're the only
say
one who
point,
can answer this now.
Yeah,
unless the video exists. Does the video still exist?
I don't the raw footage?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean Jeff definitely said this, that whole I want to donate and dedicate, and then somebody correct him. I hate to break this to you, but I have no recollection of who said it.
Well, that's perfect.
It could have been me and Todd at the same time. But either way, we all heard him say donate and we're like, wait, no.
What are you talking about?
And yeah, so no, I think we both said it simultaneously. I'm going to stick with that. We both said it simultaneously.
That's a cop out. No, I love it actually because, you know, that's I end this show every time with, you know, like Todd Skinner always said, never let the truth get in the way of the story. And I've had so many conversations with people about what history actually is.
Right.
You know, I get someone saying, well, here's the fact. This is actually what happened. And I'm like, yeah, but is it? Do you know that?
Like, right.
You just read it in a book somewhere.
Right. Exactly. You know? Exactly. So. And even when you're there, your memory is such a flawed thing.
Totally.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I mean, I have all these imagery of my whole life, but certainly of that climb. And I don't trust a lick of it. Yeah. I think it was all a wild, wild story. And it's true. It was a wild, wild story.
Yeah. Well, now the fact is you and Todd both said it
simultaneously,
at the same time. Yeah.
Always correcting Jeff.
When you're back, did you immediately decide to stay in Lander? What was that decision like? And was Todd the impetus for you staying here?
No, and no. I fully intended to move back to the Black Hills. I was in love with Black Hills climbing. Not in love with Black Hills climbers, because it was a very broken culture, but in love with the climbing there. And so I was convinced I was going back there. But I had some bills to pay, and I didn't love the climbing in Lander like I do now. Like now I think it's just a magical place, but I had a lot to do.
Yeah.
Felt like I had a lot to do.
It grows on you like a barnacle or something.
Yeah, some kind of lichen for sure. So I'd fully intended to leave. And then even after sort of committing to being here for 5-6 more years, about 5 years after that, I applied for grad school and was ready to leave. But I met this girl and at the end of the day, I hate to say it, but the reason I stayed in Lander is because I met a girl and fell in love and then also found a job. Those two things like ruined my whole life and stuck me here. Yeah. So no, I'm super lucky. I mean, obviously I moved here because Steve invited me to go on this trip with Todd.
Yeah.
Todd gave me a job, or really Amy gave me a job at Wild Iris Mountain Sports. And so I worked there for a while. And, but then I ended up sort of stumbling my way into oddly enough, the outdoor industry that I'm in right now, like more, technical gear and hunting based, took a job in 2000. And met a girl, fell in love, realized this is the perfect place to raise a family.
Yeah.
So did that. And awesome. Now I'm just working the list.
Do you remember when you heard that Todd died?
You know, I don't remember the absolute moment. I think I sort of black that out. I remember the week of that week and the conversations that we had during that time period and how angry I was at Todd. Mm. And I think that's a common response to be angry at the person who left you.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely convinced at that time that it was the end of an era. And specifically the end, which it was, but the end of specifically of end of the climbing culture in Lander. Mm. I was convinced that it was the end of Lander as a climbing destination mecca kind of place, which I was 100% wrong, probably a lot more than 100% wrong. But I was convinced it was the end of the heyday of climbing in Lander. At that time, I was climbing very little. I was still climbing by many people's standards quite a lot, but by my standards, little. I didn't feel like a rock climber, and that maybe made me even a little bit more angry. Mm. I don't remember exactly where I was. I remember when Steve told me, and immediately had an amazing grasp of exactly what happened, which is really interesting, because Steve and I had talked, and Todd actually had talked very much about equipment usage and correct and incorrect ways to do things.
Wow.
And argued quite a bit about that. Mm. So, and that's part of my anger. I'm still to this day a little bit angry, to be honest. So,
and I think all the people affected have a right to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Does that ever make it hard to be here where he's still such a presence, or does it make it another reason to be here?
There was some hardness for a couple of years. It was difficult when you saw certain people, when you went to certain places, you know, like just walking under throwing the hula hand, like just that kind of thing. There was some ache.
Sure.
But I don't feel that anymore. If anything, I feel a real that my time with him, our time with him, was a real treasure and was super, super impactful. He's such a huge part of who we are and what this town is and the people we spend time with.
Yeah.
So that part does nothing but bring me smiles. Like, it makes me super happy. So,
yeah. I mean, I never met the guy.
Yeah. Which I still can't believe. Like,
and I'm here 100% because of him.
Right.
You know,
right.
It all started because I wrote a song about him.
Yep.
I came here. I met Sarah Skinner.
Yep.
Told me I was better than Johnny Cash.
That's
and I was
awesome.
Like, wow, I got to get to know this kid.
Yeah.
You know? So I came back the next year
and
hung out with Amy, and she introduced me to Annalisa.
Yeah. And here you are.
Now here I am.
Your whole life.
And I have a bunch of holds from his wall that he trained on my wall now.
You know?
It's a wild
pathway.
Wild pathway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like we were talking about before this all started, the pathway of our lives and how random it is and how wonderful it is. No, you can't predict it. You can't plan it. You shouldn't. But damn, we're lucky for lucky people.
Yeah. I remember being in Vita Vu years ago and, you know, reading all about Todd and Paul and, you know, going to repeat Todd roots, you know, I'm going to go do Pretty Girls with Long Knives because Todd did it.
Right.
You know, and it never occurred to me that I would someday move to the state because of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Totally wild. Tell me about, other than that, the memory of Todd leading that pitch, who was Todd Skinner?
Yeah, Todd was Todd was such a diverse character. I mean, so much passion, so much intensity, so present in what he was doing. Like, it's funny because he was certainly going in 1,000 different directions and easily distracted by what's around him, yet just so the depth of what he did, each thing he did, the depth he did it was involved in it was so, it was just absorbing. Like he would just pull you along in his the vortex of energy that he was floating around. So yeah, I mean, to me, you know, Todd is, he's just this passionate laser that, you know, a laser of passion, focused on whatever it was, the next thing, the next summit. It was always about the next thing.
Yeah.
And, that was really, I mean, I have a book that he gave me, probably 2 years before he died, that's just this book of climbs. And in the front, he said, "We'll always have Antarctica." And so we always talked about, you know, even in the times when I wasn't what I would consider much of a climber, like I'd sort of taken some time, he was convinced that there was one more expedition that we could do that only we could do.
Yeah.
And I believed him.
I've heard that from a lot of people.
Yeah.
That they were pulled along in his wake.
Yeah.
And when you used the word laser earlier, my ears perked up.
Yeah.
That's such a great description of what I understand of him,
mm-hmm.
you know, from talking to Annalisa and from talking to Amy and just from seeing what he built here, you know, or
right.
helped to build here.
Oh yeah.
So that's the whole thing is really beautiful, I think.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's not without its, you know, I mean, there's not everything is happiness and sunshine,
yeah.
but it is all intensity and drive. And there's a lot of all of that all the time. And so I definitely miss it. But at the same time, he's infected so many of us with that. And you're included in that group. Because it was directly and indirectly infected so many of us, and we're still so motivated and driven. And a good portion of that, we're motivated by climbing his climbs. We're motivated by, you know, being with his family. We're motivated by being in this town. It inspired us to be the best we could be and to make great stories.
Yeah.
I've always I'm convinced, and I learned this from Todd, that the person who dies with the most stories wins. And they don't always have to be completely true. So but you just have to keep seeking out another story.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's the perfect place to wrap this up. And man, I appreciate you not only for sitting down here with me today. I'm glad we got to just sit here and stare at each other and have this conversation. This is the first in person I've done for this show, and I didn't realize how much I missed it.
Yeah, it's really fun.
And thank you for what you do and bring to this community, and for being the constant that you are. It's appreciated more than you know.
Thank you. Thank you. I love this community. I love the people, and I love the fact that I can go climbing 15 minutes from where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah. Speaking of which, where are you climbing tomorrow?
I'm climbing in a secret crag tomorrow that I can't talk about. I'm sorry to say.
Man.
I know.
Then I won't see you out.
It will be public at some point, but it's a secret. That's the thing about Lander. There's still secret crags.
I know. Well, I've got business at a not secret crag, so
perfect.
I'll be there.
Perfect. I would love to go there too.
Written in Stone is produced by me, Chris Hampton, with help from Riley Rush and Emily Holland for Plugtone Audio, a group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. The link in your show notes, you find all the things you expect, and probably some you don't, including a Bill Hatcher photo of Mike Lilligren looking like Spider-Man bouncing off of the side of Trango Tower that might be the only photo in the history of photos to inspire me to want to go to a place like that. And look, this show is 100% rooted in the facts, but like Todd Skinner always said, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And seriously, if you love what you're hearing, give us those 5 stars and a glowing review. The algorithm loves it, which means more people find it, which means sponsors will love it, which means we can make a season 2, and together we can tell the stories of climbing's most important ascents, 1 decade at a time. You guys, I just checked. It's 51 to 44. The 2000s are closing in. The 80s are still in the lead, but it's not a comfortable lead. And with 110 votes and only 7 points separating them, a single vote can make a big difference. So if you haven't yet, head in there and vote. Go to the posts and the Patreon, scroll all the way to the bottom. That's where the poll is. I think I'm going to close this poll the day that the last episode of this season airs. And that will be a wrap-up episode, I believe. That's when I'll close the poll. And maybe I'll give the rock stars and the legends some extra votes. We'll see about that. But right now, I've counted the 70s out. They got like 5%. They're gone. They're not happening. But it's anybody's game. 2000s versus the 80s. Where do we go next? Mike Lilligren. You know, I just feel really lucky to be sharing the same town with Mike. He's such a quiet force. I think maybe that's the best way to describe him. Very unassuming, quiet force, not only as a climber and in the climbing community, but in the business community as well, as a parent. I think he's a role model in so many ways that I can't even describe. So Mike, thanks for that conversation. Let's do it again soon, please. Also, big shout out to our newest rock star, Dave. We appreciate you over here, Dave. The support means the world. Riley and I have been working on a script for one of the final 2 episodes, and it's a tough one. There's no information out there, or very little anyway, and it's a little bit stressful, but I think we cracked it in the last few days, and I think it's going to be a really cool episode about someone who I guarantee you 90% of you have never heard of this person. I had never heard their name. I've mentioned their name to several people throughout this season, and many of them have said, nope, never heard of that person. Can't believe their resume and that I've never heard of them. So I can't wait for that to come out. But that's not for a few weeks yet. I am getting ahead of myself, like I tend to do. Tomorrow, I am picking the patron winners for the giveaway for the custom tension block that says Make History. It's so cool, as well as the organic skincare bundle from us, and a few other goodies that are getting thrown in there. I'll be picking those, posting those on the Patreon tomorrow, shooting emails out, and I'll tell you all next Monday who won. And speaking of next Monday, next week is the story of how big wall free climbing was opened up to the masses, and the ironic figure that did that. And I am conflicted over this episode. I don't know if that's actually true. I may not be conflicted anymore, but during the creation of this episode, I was very conflicted. And I actually went back and changed the end of the episode after having a conversation with one of the guests who you'll be hearing from. And the approach I've taken with this episode is I really think it's a masterful thing that this person did. However, the rules of how we see it and how we credit it historically, I'm not a big fan of. And that's on us. To be honest, I'm just also not a big fan of this person because of other things I've learned throughout this season. But that's neither here nor there for this episode. But that's why I'm conflicted. So we're going to get the story, but it's also going to be an examination of us and how we give credit for historical accomplishments. And then we're going to talk with a couple of different people, one of whom is going to be completely celebrating the thing, and the other is going to be critical of it, though not as critical as I am. Also celebratory. I am by far the more critical in this scenario, and you guys get to judge how you feel about it, and that's the beautiful thing here. So that's what's coming up next Monday. I'll see you then.